Welcome to Big Blend Radio with your hosts, Lisa and Nancy, editors of BigBlendMagazine.com.
Hey, everybody, welcome to Big Blend Radio's fourth Thursday Traveling the Jefferson Highway Show. We love this show because we get to find out, well, basically, it's about going down every rabbit hole we can nonstop, driving from either Winnipeg to Winnipeg, Canada, to New Orleans in Louisiana, or vice versa. There's so much history on this route that was actually established back in 1915 is when the Jefferson Highway Association was formed. And, you know, this highway, it goes down, like I said, Winnipeg to New Orleans and vice versa. However, at a certain point in history, kind of faded away again, but now it's back. The highway is back and it's being, you know, it's like a big revival and it's very exciting. And today's show, like I said, we do this every fourth Thursday. We're going to talk about more women on the Jefferson Highway. We've done one show on outlaw women. Today, we're going to talk about suffragettes. We're going to talk about women in politics. We're going to talk about all kinds of women who did sociability runs. We're going to find out what that's about. But again, I want to give the website out every time we do on this show. Go to jeffersonhighway.org. That's the main website to have a look at what the highway is about, where it goes, have a look at the maps, become a member, and also join the association on their annual conference. And this year, it's going to be in Mason City, Iowa, and that's going to be June 7th through 10th. So mark your calendars for that, especially if you're in the area or traveling around. We're going to be talking more about that on the highway on the show today. But speaking of that, our first guest is Roger Bell. He's on our show every month, and he is the president of the Jefferson Highway Association. I could get it straight just because we were all laughing before we put the record button on that I can't pronounce anything. But welcome back, Roger. How are you?
Thank you, Lisa. It's great to be back and got a great subject to talk about today. So looking forward to the discussion.
I think this is going to be fantastic. We've got two women joining us who are authors, know all about these historic ladies that we're going to be talking about. I know you've got some good stories up your sleeve, Roger, but I want to bring our first special guest on the show, Janita Mullins. She's an author, a speaker, historian, and also author of The Jefferson Highway in Oklahoma. You can go to her website, janitamullins.weebly.com, and that's J-O-N-I-T-A. M-U-L-L-I-N-S, just in case I don't pronounce anything correctly. But welcome to the show, Janita. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you so much for having me on.
Hey, this is exciting. Now, the Jefferson Highway obviously is not, you know, unfamiliar to you. Your book was named Best Nonfiction Book for 2017 by the Oklahoma Writers Federation. I see it was got a citation of merit from the Oklahoma Historical Society. So you got into writing about the highway, but it seems like you haven't stopped because you're the Jefferson Highway Association newsletter editor. So this is nonstop for you.
Yes, it's ongoing. I first became aware of the Jefferson Highway, as called the Jefferson, when I was working at a museum in Muskogee, and that would have been about 2002. And started the research then and have continued it ever since. It's a fascinating highway with a lot of great history associated with it.
So you understand what we say about rabbit holes.
Oh, absolutely.
It is nonstop. Well, we're excited. I know you're going to be talking about a lady, home to a second woman in the United States to be elected to the United States Congress. You're going to be talking about her today.
That's correct.
Alice Robertson. That's fantastic. I want to bring our next guest on first, though. We've got Pat Schultz. She is the author of Amazing Women in Early Mason City, Iowa. Again, I was saying that earlier, that this is going to be the location for this the Jefferson Highway Association conference this year. And welcome to the show, Pat. How are you?
I'm doing great. A little bit hoarse, but other than that, I am fine.
Oh, I know. I think none of us have gotten escaped from that little cough thing going around, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we hope We hope you're doing good. And so we really appreciate you being on the show today, because you definitely have done a lot in regards to not only writing about women's history, but you, I know, have been involved in writing, but also served on the board of Right on Park, a nonprofit.
Right on the Park.
Right on the Park, Frank Lloyd Wright's Historic Park Inn Hotel and Bank. And isn't that part of, Roger, that's part of the conference, right? That famous hotel.
That is our conference headquarters.
So. Ooh.
Oh, cool.
And you were the executive director, Pat.
Yes, for a time I was, probably for about 3 years and then another 2 years.
Wow.
And that's where I first got interested in the women of Mason City and this whole topic, in doing the research and working on the history book about the hotel. I discovered that the president of the bank that wanted a new building was a woman. And this was in 1907, 1908. And
wow.
I was amazed. Mm-hmm. And as I researched her, I kept coming across more and more women, and ended up writing a book about almost 50 different women in Mason City that were influential in one way or another.
Wow.
Awesome.
I did find your book on writeonthepark.org, and everybody, that's right, WRIGHT, writeonthepark.org. If you go on there, you'll see under their product list that they do have Pat's book, Amazing Women of Early Mason City. When you see all these women, that's a lot of women to write about. So that's really giving a thumbs up to Mason City. It seems that Mason City was quite progressive through history, more than what people on the outside of would understand.
And especially at the time the Jefferson Highway was put in, Mason City was booming. With the Industrial Revolution, we had a packing plant, cement plants, a brick and tile company, a car manufacturer, and a sugar beet factory that had all opened. So the transportation that it provided was just invaluable.
Mm. And so the lady I know you want to talk about is Carrie Clinton Lane Chapman Catt. I mean, her name is really that long? Like, seriously?
Yes. She used her maiden name, but she was married twice. And so, yeah, it does get that long.
Adding them on, so
yeah.
Well, that's a fact.
She was actually from Charles City, Iowa, which is about 25 miles from Mason City, but she mm-hmm. came to Mason City to teach, and then she became superintendent of schools here, and that was unusual for a woman too in that time period.
Mm-hmm.
And she got married while she was here. And she is the one who really, really started the work of women's suffrage among the women of the town.
Mm. When was she born? Like, what do you think about that? Because I know it was kind of in the 20s when she got real active. So, like, I'm trying to figure out when we talk about for that day and age for folks listening, like, what time period was she born in? She was born 1959. Yeah, January. I'm looking her up now. Oh,
1859.
I was going to say, Lisa.
Yeah, 1859.
It just made me feel like.
Listen,
ancient.
I'm surrounded by snow right now. I can barely see what I'm doing. January 9th, 1859, in Wisconsin, where we are. She died in March 9th, 1947. Oh, that's it.
Yes.
She had a good life, huh? That's a long life, which is nice. But
and after she left Mason City, a lot of her work was in Washington, D.C. and with the National Suffrage Organization.
Mm. Okay. Wow.
She was one of the most prominent suffragists in American history.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure that Pat can tell us a little bit, but her childhood home is now a museum very near the Jefferson Highway.
Yes. Yeah. And it's open. And it's a wonderful tribute to her. There is information for her about her all over because of her work with suffrage. She became involved in it in the late 1880s, actually, when she joined the Iowa Women's Suffrage Association. And then she went on and as an outstanding speaker, she gave all over, and she became president of the National American Women's Suffrage Association.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Wow. And, you know, it's at that time, too, you've got to think about standing up. And I wonder what the community was like. What did the men think of her in the community, you know, and the women around her?
Actually, she was very well supported here, highly regarded in her teaching and in her work with the school system as a superintendent. And she would return to Mason City to speak any number of times. Mm. But when she came to Mason City to speak, there would be large, large audiences, full houses in whatever venue. They would use. And the men here were particularly supportive compared to men in some places. And a good many women, almost every woman in my book was involved in some way in the suffrage movement. And Carrie's friends that she left behind here were really instrumental. Three women from Mason City, as a matter of fact, have their names on a plaque at the League of Women Voters, D.C. building as three of the 24 women from Iowa who were most involved in women's suffrage work.
Wow. This is amazing. And you have an actual history tour, a women's history tour in Mason City. Did that come before your book or after your book, or is it all part of it? How did that all come to be? And I mean, is this something that it's more through town or through the region that people do self-guided? It's pretty cool that
it's been mostly through Right on the Park. Because I wrote the book and did the research, but Right on the Park paid to have it published and they receive all of the profits. They're a nonprofit organization.
Nice.
And so you buy it from them and all of the money goes to them.
That's really nice of you.
It started out for our grand opening. And because I had been researching the woman who was president of the bank, we decided to have, there's a ladies' parlor in the hotel, a beautiful setting. And we had a ladies' tea there, and in three different times, and in period costume, I did a presentation on the women of Mason City. And this was well before I finished the book. And I have given presentations on the women of Mason City now to, I don't even know how many groups, a lot.
Mm-hmm. When you think about the women's parlors, you know, we've gone through so many historic buildings as we travel, and there was this point where like the ladies' room couldn't be near a men's room. The parlor needed to be far away from the bar and hotels and things like that. Like they really split men and women. I mean, I'm talking about, especially where we were in the West. And
yes. And the ladies' parlor was on the second floor and the gentleman's lounge was in the basement. Mason City was supposedly a dry town, but we understand from rumors that have spread throughout the years that the bar down there wasn't all that dry.
And it's not dry today. From what I look at on visitmasoncityiowa.com, there's plenty of fun to be had.
Yes.
Plenty of fun to be had. But going back to the parlor, And right now I'm in the basement, but I don't have all that, you know, wet stuff, but I'm in the basement and I can barely see. So I don't know, maybe I need glasses, Nancy. But what I wanted to say, you know, with the parlors, women's parlors and women gathering together, I think there was some kind of strength in that time frame of women getting together and making, you know, it's not just sitting and drinking tea and eating bonbons. I think that never really was what it was about. I think women got together to solve community problems, to help each other. And I think that's kind of where the women's club movement came from, is those kind of gatherings. Yes. What do you think?
Yes. And the women's club is still active here, but it isn't the same women's club that it was.
No.
In those years, it got a police woman. It worked to get public restrooms downtown. They worked on, you know, what signs could be up for advertising, and, you know, did a lot of work for the school districts, did work for the Red Cross during war years. And there were a large number of women's clubs in Mason City, and none of them were, you know, the tea and bonbon types. They did serious study work. There was a travel club, there were book clubs, there was a club where they discussed current events and politics. There were like 20 different women's clubs.
I wonder now if today, if we got back to that, because Nancy and I belonged to a women's club when we lived up in the mountains in San Diego and Julian, and I ran the music program. And started, they allowed me to do that, and they allowed men in it because they were helping me put on concerts, and we were raising funds for music education for the kids. And they were doing such amazing things, like pennies for pine trees, like there were just so many different programs, but we just didn't have enough younger members. And I often think, you know, in that setting, there were a few like my age and a little bit more, you know, maybe 5 years older than me. And a lot of them were the elders of the community, and they really wanted younger people in. And yet there was, when we were all together, all age groups, there was this teamwork. And now I wonder if we would do better in unity in this country if we had that, because it wasn't even, didn't get political so much, even though you could talk politics. It was about what could we do as women to make things better.
Yeah.
And that's why, and I kind of wish we still had these women's clubs being strong like they used to.
And that's not the case here anymore. The women's club here is pretty much a social group. I mean, they have presentations, but they're, you know, people come in and give presentations. But again, I would say 85% of the members are senior citizens. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, they really... do not do any of the kinds of activities that the women's club used to. However, we did just have, we had not had, and we now just have a county women voters league. And I'm excited about that.
That's fantastic. And I mean, that's part of the whole suffragist movement, was for women to be able to vote. You know,
yes, absolutely.
And as we see the politics and what's going on in the states, I think this is still a topic. Like one day it could be reversed. You never know.
You need to hear Pat's pig story.
You got a pig story?
Yes, I do. It's related. One of the women that was very active was a doctor's wife in Mason City, whose name was Eleanor Stockman, and she was part of the suffrage group, and she was one of the principal leaders of it after Carrie left Mason City. And she went to a conference in Minneapolis in 1908. And at that conference, they challenged every state to raise money for the national cause and to bring that money to the convention that was going to happen in 1909 in Washington, D.C. They wanted it to be something that represented the state that the woman was from, or that the group was from. So she thought and thought and thought all the way home. And finally she decided what best represent Iowa? And she said, pigs. Okay. So she set out driving on Iowa mud roads to visit farmers to ask them to donate a market pig to help raise money for the women's suffrage movement. And they did. She loaded them all up in a train car, and they painted this big suffragette sign and put it on the side of the train with the suffragette colors and everything. And the train took the livestock to Chicago, where it was sold. Now, some farmers didn't have pigs that were ready for market, and they donated corn. And she sold that at the local elevator and added that money. And then one farmer donated a litter of 8 little pigs, and she auctioned those off on the main corner of downtown Mason City.
Oh, my God. That's so funny.
It ended up, when she went to D.C., Iowa won second place for raising the most money because of Eleanor's pigs.
And, oh, my gosh.
The banner that had been on the train was taken to the convention. And Eleanor got a letter from one of the leaders saying that their poster, their big sign from the train, got more press than the whole convention did.
Oh my gosh, I love this. Oh my gosh, never, and pigs are smart, see?
Oh yeah, they are.
Oh my gosh.
They're smart, and they're cute.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, I love this. I love this.
I love piggy.
I want to go over to Janita and to talk about Alice, because tell us a little bit about her life in Oklahoma and where she was from, and you know, her way into, you know, becoming, getting elected to Congress.
Alice has a long association actually with the Jefferson Highway before it became the Jefferson. It was known through Oklahoma as the Texas Road, because a lot of pioneers had traveled out of Missouri going down to get free land in Texas. And she was the daughter of missionaries, the granddaughter of missionaries, to Native Americans there in Indian Territory. She was born in 1854 at this mission, which was located on the Texas Road, which would later become the Jefferson Highway. So she began her life with the Jefferson, and she lived very close to the Jefferson Highway. She had a school that would have sat on the Jefferson Highway in downtown Muskogee. So there's a lot of connection there between her and this highway that we are trying to promote. But she had an active life. She was not a suffragette in the that she was much more conservative, you know, than perhaps a lot of other women at that time period. But she broke a lot of glass ceilings on behalf of women and opened a lot of doors for women by things that she did in her life. Like Miss Kat, she was a school teacher. She was appointed as a supervisor of schools for the Muskogee Nation, which is a Native American nation. She was appointed by Theodore Roosevelt as the first woman to serve as a postmistress for a Class A post office. Wow. So she enjoyed a lot of firsts in her life, broke those glass ceilings. When she was postmistress, she was invited to speak at a Good Roads Association meeting that was held in Muskogee in 1906. And as postmistress, she everybody expected her to talk mostly about how they needed good roads to get the mail delivered. You know, this was what she would have been concerned with, was mail delivery, because she was the postmistress. But she also made a very important point as she was giving her talk to the Good Roads Association. Better roads are needed for farm women. And she talked about mental health, which nobody talked about back in 1906. Wow. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. And she said, farm women suffer from depression, from isolation, from loneliness. they need better roads so they can socialize, so they can get into town, so they can meet with people instead of being stuck on the farm.
Wow. And so, this is the opposite of being the women's club.
Made.
Yeah, this is the opposite of what we just talked about. Wow. Okay.
Yes.
So women farmers.
So she was advocating for women in her own way, not so much for the vote, but she was always advocating for women, and particularly women of color. She ran schools for girls who were Native American. She started a school for African American children. We had segregation here in Oklahoma, so the schools were segregated. And every school that she started about four schools, or was involved with four schools, they were all for children of color. Mm. And one of those schools became the University of Tulsa today. So she's considered a founder of a very premier private college located here in Oklahoma. So she was a first in a lot of different ways. Then in 1920, when women did get the vote, a group of Republican men in Muskogee came out to her farm. She lived on a farm herself, mm-hmm. and approached her about running for Congress. They said, "Women have got the vote now. We think that you could win if you would run." And she was chose to be a Republican because Andrew Jackson, who had forced the Indians to remove from the southeastern United States to Indian Territory, what had been a Democrat. So she could not be a Democrat because of what Andrew Jackson had done. So she was a Republican.
Wow.
And she was in a heavily Democratic district. Nobody gave her a chance of winning. Because not so much because she was a woman, because everybody was a Democrat. And so she wasn't expected to win, but she did.
How did she advertise, Jonita?
She was, and this was interesting, you were talking about clubs and everything. She was a businesswoman as well as being a teacher. She had a photography studio in Muskogee, and she had her farm. It was a working dairy farm. And she organized a group of women, business women, and they would meet out at her farm because she wanted to encourage women in business. Mm-hmm. And they would meet, and she would always serve, you know, something for them to have for lunch. And they said, "Alice, you are such a marvelous cook." And she'd cook for people all her life. "You ought to open a restaurant." So she did. She opened a little cafeteria in downtown Muskogee and used the product from farm to table from her farm in this little restaurant that she ran. And so the newspapers in Muskogee would not support her run for Congress because they were Democratic newspapers. So they would not sell her advertising, would not allow her to buy an ad for her campaign. But she had a standing contract with them to run an ad for her cafeteria. And so she put an ad in every day in the paper announcing what she was serving at the cafeteria. So because she had this in a contract, they couldn't stop her. She would slip political ads into her cafeteria ads and let people know where she was speaking or what her position on a particular issue was. She got around a lot of the roadblocks that the Democratic men were putting in front of her. And she was elected. And a lot of it was due to the veterans' vote. She was very patriotic. She started the Indian Territory chapter of the DAR because of her family being revolutionary supporters or supporters. And so she was involved with a lot of ladies' meetings. She helped start the Red Cross in Muskogee. Wow. A lot of times the Red Cross ladies would sit and knit socks for the soldiers. And Alice said, "I cannot knit socks for the soldiers. It's too sedentary an activity for me. I'll run the canteen down at the depot." And when all the troop trains would come through Muskogee, she and her Red Cross volunteers were down there handing out food to the soldiers as they would come through. And every one of those soldiers would get a penny postcard. She had been postmistress also, so this was important to her. She'd give every one of them a penny postcard already with a stamp on it, and she'd say, "Now you write your mother and let her know how you're doing."
And that's funny.
For years afterwards, she would get postcards from these soldiers from all over the world, and she kept every one of them. And so they voted for her because she had shown this simple kindness of hospitality, serving food. Somebody said of her, "What, she cooked her way to Congress and fed everybody who voted for her." And it was pretty close to true. Any soldier who walked into her restaurant would eat for free. And that was just her policy.
Nice.
So she was elected in 1920. She was handed the gavel to preside over the House of Representatives in 1921. She was the first woman to ever preside over the House of Representatives. So she was breaking these glass ceilings everywhere she went and really opening a lot of doors for women. Not doing it maybe in the more radical way that some of the suffragettes did. She was very conservative and very traditional, but she made a mark for women, and she opened a lot of doors for them.
And it's interesting to me how, you know, these two parts of the Jefferson Highway, and you have two interesting, very interesting women here. And did they ever connect? Yes, they did. You know, you can find comments. Because they weren't on the same side here, you know. Alice in her time did not really support the suffrage movement, but she was very much more conservative. And in this time, and there, you know, Miss Cat made several comments about it offhand about the woman down in Oklahoma, and you can find some of those out there. And it's just kind of fascinating as you go down the highway. These two really fascinating women of history, and but they're a lot alike, but in a lot of ways they're not alike. So it's interesting.
Yeah, I want to go back to Carrie Chapman Catt. I was just seeing that she was actually on a U.S. postage stamp that commemorated. Yeah. On the Wikipedia thing where it shows commemorating the Seneca Falls Convention. She was on there with Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Lucretia Mott, and we were just there like a few months ago, well, in summer, when it wasn't snowing, upstate New York there, and going where all these women were and standing where they stood on the corner. And it was just so, like, I don't know, when you go to these places where these women were, you know, it's like they stood here, they did stuff, they stood their ground, they did what they had to do in the way they knew best. What was their best avenue, just like we're talking about. Go ahead.
You know, and I want to comment on women in general here in Mason City in this time period. You know, the women in my book from the same time period they helped found the Eastern Star Home. They founded the YWCA in Mason City. One owned a pharmacy and a hotel. Of course, the bank president was a woman. I mean, the extent of the work that they did. You know, I had this crazy idea that women in 1880, 1890, and on through the early part of the 19th century were sitting at home cooking and cleaning and ironing and doing all that stuff, and I found out I couldn't have been further from the truth regarding these local women. And even the farm women, a very early pioneer here, whose name was Cornelia Cannon, lived on a farm just on the outskirts of Mason City. And she was an invalid and getting elderly. But she organized a club for farm women for the very reason that you just said, you know, the women were so isolated. And they would read books and talk about them. They would discuss politics. They would do their sewing and knitting while they talked. She always started with a Bible verse. But the club, my mother belonged to the club long after Cornelia was dead. Many women did. It has just recently dissolved because almost all of the women who belonged when my mother did are no longer living. My mom died 5 years ago at age 96. So her generation. Mm-hmm. But the farm women were so appreciative of that particular club from the time it was formed before the turn of the century up through the 1980s.
It's amazing. It's amazing. Janita, you know, this whole thing about farm women and mental health, when you were talking about Alice talking about that and getting, I mean, because today mental health is being talked about so much more than it's ever been. That, I mean, even in regards to veterans, military veterans, and, you know, that need for connectivity, you know, as we record this yesterday, it was Farm Rescuer Day. And it's a national, a newish kind of national holiday. Actually, it's today, sorry, as we record this. And it talks about all the things that farmers go through, all the hard work and how people go in and help each other as farmers. And I think for women, that's exactly what they needed, is women on the farm. If you go back even to like the Revolutionary War and the Civil War, these wars happen on battle on farmlands. The battles, like the Civil War, like back east in Maryland and places like Nancy and I've been there, where it's like you're with your kids and then they're having a fight outside your door that you normally are out, you know, feeding the pigs, bring up the pigs, you know, and then all of a sudden people are dying in front of you with your kids, and you, what do you do? You know, I think women on a farm, it's a little different than if you are out working the crops and the land. You know what I mean? You're in the kitchen doing that and hoping people come in at on time. And it could kind of drive some women up the wall, actually, just being in the, you know what I mean? It's still a lot of work.
It was an issue. Yes, it was an issue, probably not very, very talked about. And Alice probably didn't use the term mental health, you know, but she did use the term depression. Mm-hmm. And so she had a great understanding. She, you know, she had grown up in somewhat of an isolated situation on a mission in a Native American nation. So she understood that isolation. It was a major event for the family to get to leave and go into a town and socialize with other people. So she understood that and certainly made the point that good roads will help women, these farm women, not be so isolated and lonely, and will bring something brighter and better for their lives. And so she was always looking out for the women.
Yeah, but don't overgeneralize. You're doing the same thing I did, thinking about women of the period. My grandmothers and great grandmothers were out in the fields. They were milking cattle. They were feeding pigs. They were gathering eggs. I grew up in an Iowa farm, and I married, and I taught in a high school for 32 years. But my husband taught, but he also farmed. And because he, you know, had limited time, I have driven combines and tractors and wagons full and hauled corn to town. And I think women have been doing those things for as long as they've been married to men who were farmers. And there were some women who were farmers themselves. In fact, the woman who was president of the bank in Mason City, before she got married, she was living with her brother. And she was teaching school, and she saved enough money to buy two farms.
It's true. Well, there are women. There's a lot of women in history in farming. There really is. You know?
Yeah.
When you think about it, there really is. I mean, they're now saying, we do a lot of shows on wine and vineyards, and, you know, it's now become this big topic of women and wine, you know, as though they've never been there, but actually they've always been there. Women have been in wine. I mean, even nuns were making it way back when, you know, so it is just kind of, I think it's just been, who was the face of the farm? Who was the, you know what I mean? I don't think it is just how it's been presented through the years is where I think that generalization, like you're saying, which is 100% accurate, comes from. It's like, oh, the guy farmer, I have a friend she's a rancher, and she gets out there on her horseback and herds cattle out in Texas, and don't mess with Alice Lee. She's one of the best artists too. She's an artist, and she's like getting her master's degree and running cattle. And I mean, it's amazing. And that's what her family's been like through generations. This is generational. And I think it's getting those individual stories like we're talking about today with these ladies. I want to go to Roger because Roger's got some stories. I want to know about the two women on the sociability run, but let's talk about Miss Kimball from Shreveport. Tell us a little bit about her.
Yeah. This is a story that has fascinated me for a while. I really haven't dug into it until recently. I was made aware that one of the first directors of the Jefferson Highway Association was Miss Kimball, a woman, which was very, very unusual. In fact, she was the first woman to ever hold a director position in a highway association in the history of the United States to the Jefferson Highway. So, you know, I tried to figure out more about her story. She was born in Texas, but she married a physician that had was in Claiborne Parish, Louisiana, not too far away from Shreveport, at a community called Homer. And it's during that time period, and it's kind of interesting, all these ladies we're talking about here were within each other in age, maybe 10 or 15 years. And they all were at their prime, I would say, of influence during the time the Jefferson Highway was formed. So that's interesting. But she married, and at some point in time, think about this time period, 1908, how many cars were on the road? It was not much, you know. But people were starting to understand roads, starting to travel around more on, you know, and they didn't have good roads. Louisiana was said to have the worst roads in the United States at that time. It was said that only about 1% of its roads were really even drivable at any point in time. And her later talks indicate that the real reason she got involved in this was because she saw this as the problem for schools, her children, and farmers and other families, you know, were so isolated. And good roads became something she was involved in. She got involved in an organization to say it was a Congress of Mothers Congress, that's what it was. And what, you know, I was, what's that? Well, eventually that became the PTA, eventually named. And she got, this was in 1908 or 1909, long before the Jefferson Highway, at least 5 or 6 years before it was around. And she got appointed to be involved in that, to go to, her efforts were picked up by the governor at that time, and she was asked to go to a conference at Seattle, Washington in 1909, and it all just seemed like it started there. And you know, I always find this interesting when I study this woman. She's always known as Mrs. John L. Campbell, or Miss, you know, everything you see Kimball. Everything you see in the paper, you know, very, very seldom do you see her real name is Ada. She's always called Mrs. Kimball or Mrs. John Kimball. even in the headlines, you know, at that time period. But you know, you look at him, he was an influential physician, general practitioner physician. But they moved their family to Shreveport. And supposedly part of the reason was they were isolated where they were, and she wanted better education for her children. And then they just, the stories just keep coming about her being involved in Good Roads movements and becoming a figure in this. And it's just, the stories are fascinating. You know, 1910, she was in a national Good Roads magazine for her work in Louisiana. You know, that's very unusual at that point in time for a woman to be in the Good Roads magazine at that early time, especially. And she just kept building along. And then about 1915, when the Jefferson Highway was looking for its routing through Louisiana and into, you know, the convention in New Orleans, she got involved. And not only did she get involved, but she became the primary leader at that time in Louisiana. And she was asked to be a director. And in 1916, she came to the first convention of the Jefferson Highway, which was in my hometown of Muskogee, Oklahoma, at a building I used to work in, the Seavers Hotel building. And she was kind of almost like a celebrity at that time. Mm. When she came into the room, she had to give a 10-minute speech on Louisiana's roads. And they said that at the 10-minute barrier, they just said by acclamation, her story that she was telling them about the reasons she wanted Good Roads was so great that they were going to give her more. And actually, when she walked into the banquet room, they gave her a standing ovation. To the group here. She went back from this. She worked not only in Louisiana, she was very influential in Texas, I found out. She would drive over into Texas, talk to a lot of these women groups we're talking about, and she would tell them about the things they needed to do. They needed to beautify the highway, and they needed to plant this, and there was plans to do to plant Alberta peaches along the highway, to trees. She had all these, you know, things that she was wanting to do, and she was promoting the first. The Shreveport had a fair, and she did a Jefferson Highway Day at the fair, and it was a huge event because it was the same time that one of the sociability runs was coming through, and the premier of Manitoba, Norris, was in this, and she became the main speaker at this program, and they did a special deal where they had, when he came there, I don't know if it's her idea or someone else's, but they did. We kind of talked about this in the past. Mm-hmm. There's two red rivers on the Jefferson Highway. There's one right up near Winnipeg, and there's one near where she is. So they had a sample of the water in the North Red River, and they did one from the South, and they combined them in a goblet, and they put them together and drank from it, you know. So
I don't know if they want to do that now.
No, I don't know if they want to do that now. But she went on and on, and then her husband was killed in an automobile accident in 1921. He actually wasn't. He had a heart attack while he was driving. But she lived a very influential life in Shreveport. And even at her older age in 1950, she was named, the Optimist Club gave her a very high honor. And then she died at the age of 94 years old. And that's the story she could have told us as I was deriving all this. I'm just thinking, man, she touched so many people, and it would have been really great to sit down and really talk with her. And she was really sought out. I read a story where somebody was trying to
they were writing a journal of their travel through there. And they said that she was a busy lady, but they drove through Texas and they could see some of the things she did in Texas. When they got to Shreveport, they had to look her up. And she was busy, but when she heard they were there about the Jefferson Highway, she stopped what all they were doing and she wanted to talk with them, you know. So she has to be one of the, you know, there's a lot of pioneers of the history of the highway, but she has to be one of the ones that we preserve her history more. And that's one of my goals.
Well, when we get to Louisiana, we got to go do it. And, you know, I know that, yeah, there's going to be stuff on the future with that. So are these the women that drank the water? I mean, was this part of the two women that went on that sociability run?
A totally different story.
I was going to say the women with the with the Red River. I was going to say that's kind of like that's you know, like blood sisters. You know, teenagers, we used to like, you know, do that, like, okay, we'll be friends for life.
I think that's a good point is the fact that, you know, some of the things that Pat said earlier about we think the women did certain things, and you know, the sociability runs were, to get a little bit of understanding what they were, they were a marketing attempt. You know, there was not TV, there was not a lot of ways to advertise the highway, so they promoted it by driving it. So they would have these political figures, obviously mostly men, driving in. The premier of Manitoba might come through your community and he'd give a speech, and it was a huge deal, and they would plan and wait for these people to come to their town. And in 19, they had several ones I would call the national, really big ones. And some of them were more local, but in 1919, they had one of the biggest ever. And they did a double run. So they went all the way from Winnipeg to New Orleans, picked up the mayor and the governor in Louisiana. And they drove from New Orleans. And, you know, one of the stories that I was doing some research for a community not too far away from me, Eufaula, Oklahoma. And I ran across a story there about these two ladies from New Orleans. Her name was Belle Stanton and Mrs. Claire Knowlton. And they were both from New Orleans. And they were planning to drive the whole Jefferson Highway together without the aid of any men or anything. They were in a Buick, you know, they were driving along. And I don't know, at some point in time, they must have got separated from the group. Heck, then we know that can happen. And you know, they were having a big reception in Eufaula, Oklahoma. The governor of Louisiana was talking. There was a formal meeting, and all of a sudden they heard this commotion coming in, and these ladies came surprisingly into the deal. I'm sure they probably thought they were lost or given up or something. But they said they had had a wreck and they had some repairs to their Buick in Denison, Texas. And man, they were determined to make it all the way to Winnipeg. And they arrived and the guests were just kind of taken back to see these two ladies coming in make their deal. So we're actually going to put up a historical marker in Eufaula, Oklahoma, which will tell that story.
Oh, that's so exciting. Mm. That is so exciting. I want to go go to Natchitoches, Louisiana. Thank you, Natchitoches, Louisiana, the Visitor Bureau, Arlene, and who's on the board for sponsoring this show. And you can go to Natchitoches.com. They are on the Jefferson Highway in the Northwest section, but they're getting a marker, right? At the Northwest. I just saw that today, Roger.
At the
university, because of this, it was where people car camped, right?
This was a tourist camp. So the highway, which became very popular around 1920, as more people were driving the highway, they couldn't afford always to stay in some of the fancier hotels. Plus auto camping became like a craze, and people wanted to get out in these cars and drive. And This was, you know, there was a big business in doing camping supplies and tents and things that would go on your car. They would drive into these tourist camps, and that's where it is in Natchitoches. It's one of the camps. We have many on the route today where they were, including my hometown here in Muskogee. We actually have an original tourist camp building still here in Muskogee. So,
Okay. Well, we have to.
So, if you come into Oklahoma, which I have heard you might be coming shortly, we need to take you to the tourist camp.
Nancy and I live
that's
in
tourist. Funny. Camps. That's so.
You're talking
funny.
As we travel the country.
That's so funny.
We have our own tourist camps. It's our favorite thing on the planet. This is so cool. And you know, I with Natchitoches, it cracks me up because, you know, I've been there at the university. Nancy and I have been there and walked along the river, Cane River. And you're thinking, people drove there, camped there, and there's alligators in the water back then. Now there's not really, you're rarely seeing a gator
in
that
lake. Well, there could be, you never know.
Yeah, but I mean, because at that point it was more careful. Red River. But you never know. But I mean, I'm like, this is
well,
so
at cool. Our conference in Natchitoches in 2019, I get the great honor and privilege of giving a special award to a lady named Miss Sadie. Mm-hmm. And she grew up in the 1920s as a little girl, knowing about the Jefferson Highway. Her family knew about it, and she was always fascinated by it. So she wrote a little booklet, and she gave me a wonderful copy of it that I still treasure. And it included information about the tourist camp. And so some of the information that is going in that sign and the location of it and all that has to do, she passed away since the 2019 conference, just recently, actually. And, I got to spend an hour or so talking with her one day, and she was quite a lady, so.
Oh,
that's well, awesome.
Yeah. And so now I want to go ahead.
Can I put in a plug for the convention that's going to be in Mason City? We are so thrilled that the Jefferson, you know, that the highway, the whole thing is happening. And Mason City is also home, the childhood home of Meredith Wilson. And there is a museum here dedicated to him. Another Mason City native was a man named Bill Baird, who was a famous puppeteer, did the puppets for The Sound of Music. And his puppets are on display at our local museum. Some wonderful historic architecture. I think we're a great place to visit. Nearby is Clear Lake, Iowa, which is home to the Surf Ballroom. And my one claim to fame is that in 1959, as a sophomore in high school, I was the last concert of Buddy Holly, the Big Bopper.
And you were there?
Richie Valens.
Holy
that's
cow.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. You know, the last we actually did it wasn't on a Jefferson Highway show, but on our Big Daily Blend Spotify show, which is where we play music and talk about history. We did air a short segment about Mason City and did an honor to the Big Bopper and Richie Valens. And of course played American Pie and talked about Clear Lake and all of that. But I think you're the first person I've ever talked to that actually went to that.
Yeah,
concert.
Me either. That's and we cool. are actually going to the Surf Ballroom. Not actually, we're going to do it, go there on the caravan. We're doing a caravan. We talked about sociability runs. The Jefferson Highway Association is doing our own sociability run, recreating one of old in Iowa. So on Monday before the conference, we are, that would be the 5th, we're leaving from the Moni, Iowa. We have, in the last few weeks, I've been really working hard to get all this organized, but we got some great stops, some great things going on. We've got some great communities involved with us now. And we're going to, our first overnight will be in downtown Des Moines at the actual Deluxe Hotel, which was formerly the Des Moines Club. And in 1919, on this same trip I just told you about, they had their banquet at the Des Moines Club in downtown. So we got to stay in the same hotel, that building there. And we're going to go driving up north. We're going through some communities like Nevada, which is also on the Lincoln Highway, and they're going to have a, they have a Lincoln Jefferson Park there, and we're going to do some things there. The crossroads of the highway, Lincoln and Jefferson, is actually at Colo, Iowa, so we'll be at the famous Reed and Island Corner. We're going in overnight in Iowa Falls, and then the next morning we're going up north, and we're going to go to Clear Lake, and we're going to, and we have a scheduled appointment to tour the Surf Ballroom that afternoon, and likely go to the crash site, those who want to go there.
Wow.
And then we will head into Mason City. So, man, this is going to be a lot of fun. And if, for full information on that, just go to our website, jeffersonhighway.org. It's being updated there. And there's also a little registration deal. We just need like to know if you're coming, and that helps us understand the planning.
Yeah, everyone, that's June 7th through 10th. Real quick, Pat, before we get going, Pat, having seen that concert, I mean, can you give us like a memory from that concert? I mean, it must have been devastating. I know when I go see really good bands, there's like an adrenaline, you just, you're like, you're under this high of music, you know, an adrenaline rush. You're just, you know, it's euphoric when you see some of your favorite bands perform, and you know, you can't sleep at night after that because you're all like, and then to find out that news, you know, the next day must have been devastating. But what was that concert like for you?
Well, it was pretty full. Lots of kids there. Usually we had teen dances on Sunday night, but they had the tour going on and it was not a Sunday night. And so, yeah, our parents still, my parents still let me go and stay out till midnight. It was interesting to see the movie because they had it set up like a concert, but it was a dance. And there were probably a third of the dance floor was filled with kids standing up, you know, clapping to the music and singing along. And the rest of the dance floor was being danced on. And, you know, we had a wonderful night. And my friend that I was with won a free record. And it was, I remember the booths we were sitting in. And the Surf has a remarkable history. The original building was on the lakeside and burned down, but my parents met there. So there wouldn't be me if it weren't for the Surf Ballroom. And it has been restored. And it was rebuilt across the street. And it's been restored to what the second one looked like. And my parents went there. I went there. We, you know, we had all these teen dances there. And then, who is playing tonight? An older group. I think Herman and the Hermits.
No way.
Here tonight.
Cool. Mrs. Brown, you've got a lovely
daughter.
it has quite a history here. But imagine the teenage girls at the high school the next morning. We were a soggy mess.
I bet. That's what I was saying. Like you go in this euphoric high and then had to be like just tragic because, I mean, these were, I mean, Buddy Holly, we're going to Lubbock next. Buddy Holly.
Yes.
And we've been to his park. And I just feel like that's kind of this thing about the Jefferson Highway. The connections go off the highway, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the fact that we're going to be in Lubbock and, you know, we didn't get to go in the museum because when we first went to the park and the museum, it was in the height of everything being closed in the pandemic. But we do keep going to Lubbock, so we're gonna be there for a month. So I'm gonna make sure we go into the museum because it does tie back to the Jefferson Highway. And that's the whole point of this. I mean, when you travel on a road trip, what happens on the road trip, I know, should stay on the road trip. No, that's you know, that can stay with Vegas. The reality is, yeah, road trips and sociability runs, however you want to call it, these memories, and when people travel and go places and all of this, it's like a catalyst of change and living. It is like this thing that happens, and it connects with people around the world, which means the Jefferson Highway is not just stuck on that highway. It goes everywhere. I mean, Buddy Holly was there, and that's where, you know, all of that, you know. So I just look at, like, you know, towns we've been to, like Ritchie Valens, Hollister, California, they have him painted all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even the Ritchie Valens movie was made from a film producer. He's on our show, by the way, a few years ago, in San Juan Batista, up just next to Hollister in Central California, where Ritchie Valens lived. And really talked about, you know, they showed the Chicano side of music and what he was doing. So that's a connection back again to the Jefferson Highway all the way in California. It never ends. So again, it's all about those rabbit holes, you know?
My favorite song at the time was Chantilly Lace by the Big Bopper.
Oh, we did.
Chantilly Lace.
We did play that. We did play it. And I'm going to play it on the show on our big daily blend for you now. I'm going to have to play Chantilly Lace for you.
Yeah, I'd love it.
Okay, so we do our big daily blend, we always play music of what's been going on. So we'll play Chantilly Lace. It's only on Spotify for those, so you can listen to it. Roger, because you talked about Sadie, I think we're going to have to play Sexy Sadie by the Beatles. I don't know how Sadie may feel about that, but I think we, you know, come on, we can play that. And then we're going to talk about Carrie Underwood you know, Roger and Janita told me, you know, hey, she did kind of live, you know, she was born in Muskogee, right? In a hospital in Muskogee, and then lived in.
She went to school in a Jefferson Highway town, and she lived in a Jefferson Highway town, a small community called Napa, Oklahoma. And she lived in, went to school at Shakota High School. So
Dakota, thank you for saying that, because you know, by the time I already couldn't pronounce it, Chukata. Mm. So we're gonna play that song on the show, on the other show. I ain't in Chukata anymore. Chukata. Am I saying
Shakota?
Shakota, see?
Shakota.
I can't do it. Shakota. The Lisa. Only way Shakota. I know how to do it. Hey, listen, I can pronounce Natchitoches. And because I went there,
but that's, so I have to go to the place. Shakota.
One of you mentioned, you know, the worldwide impact. We have had visitors to Frank Lloyd Wright's Last Standing Hotel from over 50 different countries. And year the Surf Ballroom has a tribute concert on that first weekend in February when the original happened. People come from England and all over. I was in Japan and I was talking with some young men. They wanted to know where I was from, and I said, well, you wouldn't recognize it. And they said, well, tell us anyway. I said, Clear Lake, Iowa. And one of the young men said, oh, Buddy Holly.
Wow, how cool. How cool.
That's awesome.
That's cool.
Before we go, because we do have to run, because we're getting out of time here. I want to go back to Janita. So you do walking tours, history tours in Muskogee. I want people to know you know, about that, because you know, you're on the Jefferson Highway and people need to know about it.
Yes, I do walking tours, including the park where the tourist camp is, and the neighborhood where Alice Robertson's house is. And I do a variety of them downtown Muskogee. You can find that on Facebook, and my tours are called Oki Heritage Tours.
Oh, cool.
Cool. Awesome.
And people can go to your website again, janitamullins.weebly.com. Also for Pat Schultz, her book, you can go to writeonthepark.org, and that's right, W-R-I-G-H-T, writeonthepark.com, and go to, you've got to go to Mason City, Iowa. So their website is visitmasoncityiowa.com, and also the Jefferson Highway Association, to learn everything about the Jefferson Highway. and become a member so you get their newsletters, so you get all the information and all these cool stories. Go to jeffersonhighway.org. And if you're in the tourism industry on the Jefferson Highway, definitely you want to be part of that. So jeffersonhighway.org is the website. Thank you to Natchitoches Arlene over there in Natchitoches, Louisiana. And I'm going to spell it, and it's Natchitoches, not Natchitoches, which I would have said for years, like, you know, Nancy. But it's Natchitoches. .com. That's the website to learn about Natchitoches, Louisiana. Go get a meat pie and really sink in. So if we talk about women's history, Natchitoches is that is like a city of women's history. You gotta go. And thank you for joining us, everyone. Keep up with us at bigblendradio.com. Again, we do our Jefferson Highway shows every fourth Thursday with Roger. He always brings amazing guests like these two lovely ladies on the show today. Thank you, Pat. Thank you, Janita.
Super cool.
Thank you, Roger. Thank you so much.
You're most welcome. I've enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Thank you, ladies. And thank you, Roger.
You're welcome. Glad to be here. And we'll look forward to next time.
Cool.